Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the just-completed G20 summit in Australia, at which Vladimir Putin was the odd man out in terms of being ganged up on because of escalating Russian aggression in Ukraine, while the host, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott, was the odd man out in trying to keep global warming off the summit's agenda, while, based on racist ignorance, isolating Australia from global efforts to combat Ebola as the only advanced nation refusing to allow its doctors and healthcare workers to go to West Africa. Salvatore Barbones, an associate professor in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, joins us from China, where he is just returning from Vladivostok in Russia's Far East, where he was able to assess the reactions of Russians to their growing global isolation. Then we will speak with Iraq expert Juan Cole about the latest beheading by the Islamic State of an American aid worker and the surprise visit of America's top general Martin Dempsey, who met with the new Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi in Baghdad before going to Erbil to meet with the Kurdish Prime Minister Barzani. We will discuss how much domestic American politics are shaping America's strategy in Iraq that does not appear to make any sense as the U.S. becomes the air force of the Iranian-backed Shia. Then finally, we will get an update on the growing outrage in Mexico over the disappearance of 43 students at the hands of a drug gang with ties to local politicians of the leftist PRD party in Guerrero State. Tim Johnson, the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, joins us to discuss how this latest atrocity in the ongoing mayhem from the war on drugs in Mexico has turned into the last straw that broke the camel's back and is now threatening the administration of President Peña Nieto as corruption scandals linked to him and his wife begin to surface. And joining us now is Salvatore Barbones, who is an associate professor in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Salvatore Barbones.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on the program.
And you've just returned from Vladivostok in Russia's Pacific Eastern regions. You're now in China. You were in Vladivostok for a conference on the state of U.S.-Russian relations. Tell me about that conference. Under whose auspices was it held? And what was the theme of the conference?
Well, it wasn't actually a conference. I was invited to speak at Far Eastern Federal University in Vladivostok. Far Eastern Federal University is the flagship international institution in the Russian Far East, founded on the orders of Vladimir Putin himself. It was an amalgamation of several universities, and it's focused on being Russia's face to the Pacific.
And I take it that while you were there, Vladimir Putin was staying in the same hotel.
That's right. In between the APEC conference in Beijing and the G20 in Brisbane, I guess Putin had to have some rest and recuperation back in Russia. And in fact, he flew into Vladivostok and stayed in my hotel complex, or at least his retinue did. I did not see the man himself, but I did see many armored SUVs.
So, and of course, Vladimir Putin said that he had to leave the G20 conference in Brisbane early because he needed to get some sleep for the long journey back. So tell us about what the impression that you got from your Russian hosts about where relations stand, because the G20 meeting in Brisbane that's just concluded, almost everybody ganged up on Putin. He was very much the odd man out.
The great hope of Russian international relations experts is that somebody will support Russia in an alliance against the United States and its allies. Now, of course, their preferred somebody would be China. Unfortunately for Russia, they discovered at the APEC summit, just before G20, that China would be aligning with the United States. And if you remember, President Obama and Xi Jinping of China announced a series of agreements immediately after the APEC summit in Beijing. So going into the G20, Putin had already suffered a real embarrassment because instead of being embraced by China, in an alliance against the United States, Xi Jinping really left Putin out in the cold and instead shook hands repeatedly with Obama, both literally and metaphorically, with this series of agreements.
Well, at the G20 summit, Putin, for example, the Canadian Prime Minister, in the photo opportunity with Putin, said, "I guess I'll shake your hand, but I have only one thing to say to you. You need to get out of Ukraine." And apparently Putin was extremely annoyed by that. But other leaders weighed in on him too, Cameron of the UK, etc. So he was basically castigated by everybody. And of course, prior to him coming, the Australian host had threatened to shirt front him, which is a term from Australian football to chest butt somebody. And then in response, Putin had sent some warships off the coast of Australia. What's your impression of the way the Australian Prime Minister handled this, hosting this G20, given that, one, he had picked this fight with Putin prior to Putin's arrival, two, he had tried to keep global warming off the agenda just after the US and China had made an historic announcement of an agreement. Three, he had kept Australia, along with North Korea, are the only countries on the planet that are refusing to send people to West Africa to deal with Ebola, and that's entirely because of Prime Minister Abbott's insistence. So in general, lots of demonstrations against Abbott from environmentalists, people digging holes in the sand and burying their heads, etc. What was the impression? I know you've been in Russia, but it strikes me that the host for this meeting was just as much the odd man out as Putin was.
Well, Abbott is doing everything he can to pick a fight with Putin, and I think the reason is obvious. He wants to draw attention away from his own problems domestically in Australia. In addition to the snubs you've mentioned, while other world leaders were met by cabinet officials from Australia, Putin was greeted by an assistant, essentially an Australian assistant secretary of defense, so a low-level defense official was assigned to meet Putin. The warships off the coast were certainly there long before the G20 summit started and before the icy greeting Putin received, but they were made a huge deal of in the Australian media, especially in the News Corp media, the Rupert Murdoch media in Australia. They were characterized as an Australian fleet. I'm sorry, a Russian fleet off the Australian coast. Of course, if by fleet you mean a cruiser, a destroyer, and two tenders, well, then there was a Russian fleet off the coast. And if by off the Australian coast you mean in Papua New Guinea, not in Australian waters, then you complete the picture. Russia, of course, is a global power that has ships and airplanes everywhere. In fact, just last week there was news of a Russian bomber patrol in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's certainly nothing out of the ordinary for one or two Russian ships to be somewhere in the vicinity of Australia. But to listen to Australian media, you would think it was a Russian invasion. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. And in fact, Australia scrambled two ships that were supposed to come home on shore leave to go, quote-unquote, greet the Russian, quote-unquote, fleet. So certainly Tony Abbott is doing everything possible to keep Russia in the news and himself out of it. Now, of course, Australia is a democracy. There's a big Ukrainian minority in Australia, and anything anti-Putin plays well to that Ukrainian minority. And in fact, Ukrainians, nationalists, were protesting in Brisbane against Putin's presence at the G20 summit. But Tony Abbott's problems run much deeper than a physical fight with Vladimir Putin, especially when it comes to isolation over the climate and even isolation within Australia. He's perhaps not as unpopular as Barack Obama, but he's giving Obama a run for his money.
And again, I'm speaking with Salvatore Bobonis, who is an associate professor in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. I'm speaking to him in where he is in China at the moment, just having returned from Vladivostok in Russia's Far East. Back to your Russian colleagues that you met with in Vladivostok at the same time that Vladimir Putin was staying in the same hotel as you. What is their sense of Russia's isolation over Ukraine? What do they think that they're gaining from the fact that there's escalation in military hardware being sent across the border at the moment, which, of course, Vladimir Putin denied. But clearly, I don't know what kind of media coverage the Russians are getting, but you get the increasing impression that most of the world is pretty much fed up with Putin.
Russians live in a fantasy land filled by fueled by state-controlled media. In Russia, it is taken for granted that Ukrainian fighters shot down a Malaysian airliner over Ukraine, that Russia is a peaceful country that is repeatedly provoked by the West, and that Russia's motives in its international policy are purely defensive and solely for the good of humankind. And people seem to believe this, not just ordinary people, but even academics who study international relations. Now, maybe that's not surprising, because in order to be promoted in Russian academia, you have to have pro-regime views. I don't know how sincerely people hold those views, but they certainly express them often and repeatedly in public. But they seem genuinely not to understand why Russia is isolated on the world stage. And they take it for granted that any country that has a quarrel with the United States will, of course, join Russia. And I think recent events in China show that that's just not true. China is announcing ever closer ties with the United States. Iran is negotiating to settle its nuclear disputes with the United States. All over the world, countries would much rather ally with the United States, or at least resolve their problems with the United States, than ally with Russia. Russia is not really a very attractive ally on the world stage, and Russians don't seem to understand why.
And do you think that Putin understands why? I mean, how much do you think Russia's situation in the world today is driven by Putin? Personalities, in many ways, play as much a role in international relations as policies do.
Everyone seems to agree. Everyone within Russia and outside it seems to agree that Putin is the master of the situation. And personally, I doubt that Putin shares the fantasies of his people. That is, to my mind, Putin has played a poor hand extraordinarily well. That is, given a difficult situation in Ukraine, he has seized those parts of Ukraine that are most important for Russia's strategic interests. Russia has used sanctions to bolster the legitimacy of the regime at home. Putin's popularity ratings are sky high within Russia. They're over 80%. If an election were held today, there would be no need for Russians, for Putin to manipulate the vote. Putin would win with an 80% or an 85% majority, legitimately, in a clean election. So I think Vladimir Putin is in many ways the mastermind who is making sure that things work out as well as possible for Vladimir Putin and for his cronies and allies, and even in a way for Russia, in that it's hard to imagine a policy that would actually be better for Russia. Russia's current policy leads to its isolation, but would a friendlier policy on the part of Russia result in victories for Russia around the world? It's hard to imagine that that's the case.
So is this approach that the West has, which is to further sanction Russia for military incursions into Ukraine, which are likely to increase, and with the new Republican Congress, particularly with Senator McCain as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, there's a possibility that the U.S. will start supplying military equipment to Ukraine, thus escalating the situation further. This seems to be inexorable, but I guess it plays further into this narrative of Russian victimhood and being surrounded and the world ganging up on him. So the idea that everybody ganged up on Putin at the Brisbane G20 seems to basically play into that scenario.
Well, the irony is that the narrative of Russian victimhood is accurate. Russia is surrounded, Russia is isolated, and in many ways Russia is a victim. It's a victim of its geography, and it's a victim of its own politics. But there is no imaginable scenario under which Russia becomes a universally loved member of the global community. Even before the events in Ukraine of the last 12 months, Russia was already not exactly isolated, but certainly unloved on the world stage. And I don't think it could have done anything to ensure a better outcome for itself. Its actions are certainly not acceptable by global standards, and its actions are certainly unfair to the people of Ukraine. But Russia did ensure that it maintained its naval base in Sevastopol, in Crimea, at a time when it looked like all of Crimea was going to turn into the Western camp and eventually join NATO. So Russia has played a very bad hand extraordinarily well. That said, it is a very bad hand, and I don't see any way that Russia can really reverse its fortunes to become a normal European country.
So given that bleak scenario, and what you said earlier, Salvador Bobon, is that after Putin had met with President Xi at APEC, he was hoping that the gas deals would be the glue that leads to a greater relationship. And of course, you have this extraordinary paradox of a billion plus people on one side of the border and virtually no Russians on the other side of the border in the Russia's Far East.
You know. 6 million people in the entire eastern third of Russia.
6 million.
6 million. It's unbelievable how sparsely populated the Russian Far East is. It's almost empty.
And China, of course, is resource hungry and a huge country with a massive population. Is that, to what extent have these two countries buried the hatchet in their traditional suspicion of each other?
Well, I don't think they have at all. This was really all the talk at the APEC summit in Beijing. All the talk was of potential Russian-Chinese alliance against America, and that simply did not turn out to be the case. And ironically, my speech at Far Eastern Federal University focused on a prediction that China, in the long run, would choose the United States as a partner, not Russia. All the Russians thought I was crazy to say that, and then 2 days later, we got the newspapers, and they announced wide-ranging deals between the United States and China, with Russia left out in the cold.
So what do you think the reaction will be? Will that just reinforce the sense of victimhood on the part of the Russians?
Oh, I think it will. But I think we have to distinguish what we would like to see in Russia and what is good for the people who govern Russia. A sense of victimhood is very instrumental for the current government, the current regime in Russia. When we say that the only route for Russia to join the peaceful ranks of nations is for a complete change in the way it governs itself, effectively what that means is for Putin to resign and to allow somebody else to run the country. And I see no reason why Putin would want that solution. I think that a sense of Russian victimhood, a sense of encirclement, really helps to keep Putin in power in a way that cooperative relations would not. Putin was not very popular 2 years ago. He has become very popular because of the isolation of Russia on the global stage. A Western leader might view isolation as a problem. For Tony Abbott, global isolation is a problem for Australia. It hurts his approval ratings. But for Vladimir Putin, it's fantastic for his approval ratings.
Well, but the cynical interpretation of that is that Putin is distracting the Russian people, while him and the Siloviki, the former intelligence officials and oligarchs around him, steal the country blind.
Oh, I think that analysis is absolutely correct. But it's also very rational.
In meaning what?
Well, it's very rational for Putin and his cronies and the current leaders in Russia. Most middle-income countries, Russia, China, India, Indonesia, are all characterized by massive concentrations of wealth at the top and massive capital outflows among people at the top. Chinese millionaires and high party officials are all getting U.S. passports and emigrating to the U.S., Canada, and Australia. Russian leaders all have their children in London and have their money in London. In fact, the ruble has declined 50% in value since the sanctions were put in place in April. Most people think that the ruble has declined because of the sanctions. In fact, many economists believe that the ruble has declined because the Russian Central Bank has been lending money on loose terms to Russian companies to make up for the sanctions, and those companies are just turning around and sending the money overseas. That is, they're floating, they're riding the ruble. They're simply sending the money overseas, letting the ruble fall, and then taking the profits. And in fact, the Russian Central Bank announced last week that it would scale back support to companies that are affected by sanctions, because the support is not being used within Russia. The support money being made available is just leaving the country and going to London to international markets. It's really amazing. The lack of patriotism, the lack of integration in countries like Russia or China.
Well, that is a story that we should follow up on, because it is the, I believe, the real truth of the matter, and it just shows you how money makes the world go round, I guess.
It certainly does.
I thank you so much for joining us, Salvatore Bobonis.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Again, I've been speaking with Salvatore Bobonis, who's an associate professor in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He joined us from China, where he is on his way returning from Vladivostok in Russia's Far East. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the latest beheading by the Islamic State of an American aid worker and how much domestic American politics are shaping America's strategy in Iraq.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. It's all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound that makes the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and is the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And predictably, Juan, the press is going crazy over the latest beheading of an American aid worker by the Islamic State. It seems that that is, you know, isn't that why they're doing it? Aren't we just sort of taking the bait by reacting in the way that we do?
Sure. You know, there are lots of murders in the world. Why we would highlight these murders is a little mysterious. It should be remembered that this organization has suffered some very severe setbacks just in the past 2 weeks. Its leader, Ibrahim Asmarai, appears to have been badly wounded by a U.S. airstrike on a convoy near Mosul, and to the point where he had to issue an audio message rather than a video one recently. And then they just lost their position in Beji in Iraq, which is a refinery town, and refineries are what turn crude oil into gasoline and kerosene. Gasoline and kerosene are easily smuggled, and they're lucrative. Crude oil is worthless until it's refined. So losing that refinery is a huge economic blow to them. So they've actually been put back on their heels, and I think this is the action of a cornered rat.
And it's also possible that the actual executioner, this jihadi who has a British accent, he's alleged to have also been wounded by an American airstrike. Meanwhile, Army General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, has visited Baghdad, where he met with Prime Minister Abadi, and then he went on to Erbil to meet with the Kurdish Prime Minister Barzani. But I failed to see what the American strategy is. It seems to be politically driven in Iraq. On the one hand, the Republicans are afraid. They don't want to anybody to remind them that it was a Republican war prosecuted by Bush and Cheney and company that led to this Iraq disaster. And on the other side, on the Democratic side, Obama doesn't want to be the American president who lost Iraq. And Hillary Clinton, who's likely to be running in 2016, doesn't want to be the American president who served in the administration that lost Iraq. So is that why they're keeping this fiction alive that Iraq is still a country?
Yes, the American policy appears to be primarily being driven by domestic political considerations. You wouldn't put together a military strategy that looked like this if you were in your right mind. So the only explanation for it is that they're doing it as a domestic political strategy. I mean, in essence, if ISIL is in fact important, and if it needs to be destroyed, then likely the only way you could destroy it in any relevant time frame in Iraq would be with Iranian help. And de facto, although both sides would vehemently deny it, and de facto the U.S. and Iran are now fighting on the same side against ISIL. In Syria, on the other hand, Iran is with the Bashar al-Assad government, and the U.S. Maintains that it wants to overthrow that government at the same time that it wants to roll back ISIL. If it rolls back ISIL, likely the Bashar al-Assad government will be the beneficiary of that, and so will Iran. But the U.S. wants to undo that benefit to them by training up more of the Free Syrian Army, what they call the moderates, in hopes of keeping a guerrilla war going against the al-Assad government, but not the ISIL kind of far-right crazy jihadi government, but a government of Syrian Sunnis and others who believe in democracy and so forth. But, you know, nobody on the ground thinks that this three-point plan in Syria is likely to succeed or makes very much sense. So you work back from the policy positions. The policy position is the Bashar al-Assad government has to go, ISIL has to be defeated, and then you're implementing a military strategy in accordance with those considerations, which really is bad for the military, I think.
And at this point, though, you mentioned that the U.S. and Iran are in a sort of de facto alliance, and I guess the U.S. has become the Shia Air Force.
Yes, well, they are in a de facto alliance in Iraq, but they are at odds in Syria. I don't know how you can depend on a country in one theater of war, but be at daggers drawn with it in a nearby theater of war. the Syria and the Iraq pieces don't fit.
Well, at this point, though, the Shiite government in Baghdad appears to be, you know, it's obviously been very close to Iran, and we know that in about a week's time, the deadline for the P5+1 deal with Iran, and there, at this point, my understanding is that Iran is laundering its oil through Iraq, and an enormous amount of money is being made by the leadership. But there's tremendous pressure within the country to normalize and to get back into the join the world community. One doesn't really know. We know that there are people on both sides who want to sabotage the deal. In Congress, there's a tremendous push from AIPAC, the Israel lobby, to undermine the deal. The minute it, trying to strangle it in its cradle, if you will, and they have pretty much got a lot of the Congress on board, led by Senator Menendez. And then on the Iranian side, it would seem that the hardliners also want to sabotage that deal. So, what would be the incentive for, what is the reason why Iran and the U.S. are not only on the same page in terms of their military activity in Iraq, but they also seem to be on the same page where they want to also maintain the fiction of the country being united? What's the Iranian motive for wanting Iraq to stay together when it's clearly falling apart?
Well, the Iranians want to put Iraq back together for geopolitical reasons. First of all, a Sunni caliphate, so-called, in western and northern Iraq, they see as something that might benefit Saudi Arabia, although the Saudis appear to be afraid of it now. And an independent Kurdistan threatens Iran because Iran has its own Kurdistan of some 4 million people. They don't want secessionist activities to spread there. So Iran is going to be much happier if Iraq is a unified state, a federal unified state. It can be like Canada with a kind of two Quebecs. But they don't want it breaking up because it would have an impact on their position, even on their own territorial integrity. On the other hand, they do want it to continue to be dominated by the Shiite majority in Iraq, which is, of course, largely favorable towards them.
So if Iraq were to, you know, the Kurds have all but seceded, and so have the Shia in the sense that they're certainly self-sufficient because that's where a lot of the oil is, and that's also the reason why the Kurds are largely self-sufficient because there's oil up there. It's difficult to know what would sustain a Sunni state in the middle there, but I take it the very existence of a Sunni state would cut across the lines of the so-called Shia Crescent, linking Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Assad regime in Syria?
Sure. That Caliph Ibrahim is interfering with the shipments of munitions and money from Iran to Lebanon, although some of that can go through Damascus Airport. No, Iran wants to push these radical Sunnis back. It is threatened by them as a Shiite country, and then they're geopolitically inconvenient to it. If I were a betting man, I would guess that Iran wins this one over time. Iran is a country of 75 million. It's an oil state. It has a very well-organized military establishment, including a national guard in the form of the Revolutionary Guards, and a fine, if often somewhat dastardly, special operations organization, the Jerusalem Brigades. So the Iranians will be applying enormous pressure on ISIL. And the President Obama recognizes this. He appears to have sent Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader in Iran, a letter as a sidebar to their nuclear enrichment negotiations, which had to do with cooperation against ISIL. And one hears behind the scenes in Washington the allegation, at least, that, you know, the U.S. has not struck at any Syrian regime installations since it started bombing Syria. It's targeted ISIL and al-Qaeda. And that the reason for this is that Obama needs Iranian support in Iraq and doesn't want to anger them.
So then the Obama administration has essentially sold out the Syrian revolution.
Without wanting to say so. So this is the point of saying, well, we're going to train up 5,000 in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and we're going to support not so much the existing FSA or Free Syrian Army, because it's proven to be ineffective. And in fact, it just lost a whole province, Idlib, to al-Qaeda. But to create, you know, a force of what we call vetted fighters, people that were sure of their loyalties. And but, you know, an enterprise like that takes years. And by that time, the war may be over with, and Bashar may well have won it. So the rhetoric is that they have not sold out the Syrian revolution.
Well, but they did in the very beginning. I mean, the reason why you can't train up the Free Syrian Army is that most of them are dead. Their best fighters are already dead. I mean, they were never properly armed. They were never supported. When you had all of those Syrian soldiers defecting from the army because they refused to shoot their own citizens demonstrating in the streets, presumably that was the time when Hillary Clinton was talking about that Assad's going to fall. And he clearly hasn't. It's mystifying to me why the U.S. Sat on its hands then and now is going through this charade now when it's too late, that they're trying to create a Free Syrian Army.
Well, the U.S. sat on its hands, I think, in large part because it was very unclear that an intervention of the sort that Hillary and General Petraeus wanted would work. And, you know, the Reagan administration did this in Afghanistan and had a success of sorts. But then we've had, you know, 30 years of Afghanistan being in turmoil, and it became a national security threat to the United States. Was the Reagan misadventure in Afghanistan may well have, you know, been an essential background to the 9/11 attacks. So one of the problems with the U.S. arming revolutionaries in a place like Syria is that everything is in flux, and people that you think you can trust or who are on your side for the moment or who are willing to support holding elections once they win go off, you know, in other directions over time and join al-Qaeda. And so whatever arms the U.S. might have given the rebels in 2012 might well now be in the hands of ISIL and al-Qaeda. So I don't fault the Obama administration for not wanting to get involved in this thing. And I don't think there were good options. There was no United Nations Security Council resolution authorizing the use of force, in the absence of which you would be undermining international law by going in. And then just feeding in arms from the outside without really any control over what happens to them, you know, then you would end up with Libya.
Well, but what they've ended up with, or what we have ended up with and the world has ended up with, is an extremely dangerous and toxic situation with all of these crazy jihadis. So, you know, you couldn't have a worse situation. I'm certainly not advocating wars and arming people. I'm just looking at the recent history and thinking, you know, how could it be much worse than it is?
Oh, I guarantee you, Ian, it could be worse.
Well, just in closing, then, what's your sense of whether or not, I mean, if this is a political situation in Iraq, and the reason there's no strategy is because the Republicans don't want to be reminded that Bush, Cheney, and the Republicans created this mess in the first place, and the Democrats don't want to be pinned for losing Iraq. And so we got this phony strategy that makes no sense, that has these massive internal contradictions. Is this just this agony going to go on through 2016, you know, and everybody trying to keep it off the headlines while the Islamic State runs around trying to find Americans to execute?
Yes, the agony will go on. Although, here is an important consideration. I think whatever the rhetoric about the strategy might be, at the very least, there is a containment strategy. And that containment strategy actually has had some fair success. Northern and Western Iraq joined ISIL. It wasn't so much that ISIL conquered them. It was a political revolution. But they joined on June 9th. And then they were going to go on and take Baghdad and Erbil, that is to say the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan and the capital of Iraq, and made moves in that direction. And since the Iraqi army had collapsed and ran away, and then the Kurdistan paramilitary didn't acquit itself very well in those early battles, it looked as though the whole of Iraq might fall. And whether that was likely or not, that was the image. And so President Obama's intervention has rolled them back, ISIL, from Kurdistan. And now it seems very unlikely that they'd be able to make much progress in the capital of Baghdad. They did capture some assets, such as the oil refinery at Beji, but now they've lost that. So in Iraq itself, it's a seesaw, but the at the moment, and then Ibrahim Samurai has been wounded, along apparently with some of his commanders, in a strike on the convoy just a week and a half ago. So this is why General Dempsey is saying, you know, the strategy is showing some success. I would say there hasn't been a lot of rollback, but there's been a containment, and that's probably the best they can do at the moment.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and is the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the growing outrage in Mexico over the disappearance of 43 students at the hands of a drug gang with ties to local politicians of the leftist PRD party in Guerrero State.
جيتني بجوز عيونه على سمار الحنطاوي
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. And between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you, Ian.
And the growing outrage, or the persisting outrage in Mexico over the disappearance over a month ago of 43 students, it seems that the families of the victims simply don't want to believe what the government has told them. They met with Peña Nieto. He apparently, I think he arrived back from a trade mission to China on Saturday night. But it looks as though Peña Nieto himself is in trouble because of revelations of a private $7 million home, which Peña Nieto's wife is buying on credit from a company whose owner got a big government contract from Peña Nieto when he was ran the Mexican state, was the governor of the Mexican state. And, of course, the owner of this home is also was part of that Chinese-led consortium for the bullet train contract that was cancelled because of outcries over the bidding process not being transparent. This has turned not only into a national outrage about Mexico's citizens wanting something to be done about corruption and impunity. Here you have corruption and impunity pointing right at the president and his wife.
That said, I wouldn't underestimate the fact that this is a crisis for all three major political parties. Peña Nieto certainly is facing the biggest challenge in his 2 years so far of his six-year term. But in the case of the missing students, the leftist PRD really controls the state of Guerrero, and so they're on the ropes with that crisis. And in terms of the graft that's clear occurred in the case of this mansion, this is a $7 million mansion in the Lomas de Chapultepec neighborhood, and it's been known that it's, the First Lady has claimed that that this is her residence, but it never appeared on the list of the official list of assets of Peña Nieto himself. And so while this is really a crisis for him, and he's got a lot of explaining to do about why this isn't influence peddling, it's, you know, this is just common practice for Mexican politicians.
Well, I suppose that the fact that the other parties are tainted, and the PRD in particular, because of what's going on in Guerrero State, they're not making a big deal out of the PRI's problems, are they? Because they've all got problems, right?
They've all got problems, and in fact, from the ranging from López Obrador, the left candidate who broke with the PRD and is more to the political left than the PRD, all the way to elements in the PRI, they've all had their pictures taken with the mayor of Iguala, the city where the students disappeared. He's now in jail, formally charged with murder. But it's, everybody's running for cover with these scandals. And that's what makes it so fascinating for us journalists at this time, is that it really has exposed, a multi-layered network of people tolerating corruption, but also tolerating outright criminal activity that led to this, this horrendous crime where it appears that these 43 students have been, killed and incinerated in a massive pyre.
Well, my understanding is that this mayor of Iguala and his wife, Marita Los Angeles Pineda, they were known locally as the Imperial Couple, and that this scandal over the 43 students who have disappeared for over a month, which is, it's hard to believe that in a country that's had such mayhem for so long, with 22,000 people disappeared in the war on drugs, 100,000 plus dead, 6,000 immigrants from Central America disappeared since 2010. That the idea that this is the straw that broke the camel's back. But it's not going away, is it, Tim? Because on November the 20th, about a week away, there's going to be a national caravan of protesters converging on Mexico City, led by some of the families of the missing 43 students.
Yeah, it's going to be a big event. That's coming on this coming Thursday. Here's the complexity of the situation in Mexico is that there are other groups who are trying to piggyback on this national sense of outrage that's particularly hit the middle and lower classes. And so some of the protests have turned violent. And, you know, Peña Nieto got back last night from this trip to China and Australia and immediately lashed out at the violence. And so he's trying to straddle this line with in which he's trying to be present a public face of being understanding of the, you know, the anger and anguish of the parents of these students and parents all over the country, and yet at the same time doesn't want to give free rein to, you know, a violent protest. It's a difficult political exercise that he's engaged in now. You know, Mexico has this sort of a certain anarchist groups, specifically operating out of UNAM, the big public university here, who have, you know, all kinds of complaints about the political situation. And they, so it's been common that the protests have turned violent for reasons not particularly related to this student disappearance.
Well, Tim Johnson, again, the McClatchy bureau chief in Mexico City. I understand, though, that this incident with the disappearing students over a month ago and all the horrible information that's come out so far, and unfortunately and sadly, many of the parents still are holding out hope that their kids could be alive, simply because they don't believe the government or whatever the government says, such as the alienation between citizens in Mexico and their government. But I believe this case of the missing students is being compared to the Mexico City Square massacre on the eve of the 1968 Olympics.
That's true, and it's commonly being compared. You know, this doubt on the part of the parents is really explicable because the government delays in really engaging in the case. You know, the federal government wanted to throw it off on the city and the state of Guerrero, and didn't really, you know, take up the criminal case about this disappearance for something like 11 days afterward. And then the explanation about how they captured the fugitive mayor and his wife really kind of defied credibility. They showed video in which the wife had three different blouses on, so it appeared that it had been a compendium of video taken at different times, and it just, you know, a lot of people said this, they're putting on a show. That's a common expression that one hears here. It's all part of a theatrical, you know, handling of this crisis on the part of the pre-government. So, you know, that the parents wouldn't believe the explanation, I guess for me, as someone who's not a Mexican but has been here several years, I understand it, because it just, some things just don't quite add up.
So that just feeds the general narrative and the disquiet that people have over corruption and impunity, doesn't it?
You know, this is a, you know, confluence of events. It's not only the disappearance of the 43 students, it's the execution by the army on June 30th in a town called Tlatlaya in the state of Mexico, in which the government just completely dragged its feet on acknowledging that an execution took place. And it was only through pressure from the media, in which witnesses came forward and said, yes, this was an execution, that the government finally said, you know, in late September, said, okay, it was an execution. Three soldiers are in jail for first-degree homicide in that case. Then along came the students, and then along came this scandal over this mansion. It's really, you know, a series of events that has caused credibility to really wane. And let me add another point, Ian, that this series of crises, the students and the scandal over, you know, the corruption scandal with the mansion, it's really hurt Mexico overseas. So, you know, you start seeing articles, a leader in The Economist talking about you know, which just 2 years ago talked about Mexico's moment, is now saying there's real serious problems here. Major newspapers from New York to London to Paris are talking about Mexico in terms that are going to hurt investment here in the future. And that's what Peña Nieto was relying on, really, to be able to keep the PRI in power beyond his own six-year term.
But the $7 million mansion, the current scandal from the mansion that was essentially given on some, you know, credit terms to the wife of the current president, and the guy that owned the mansion, of course, his company was involved with the Chinese company that were going to build a bullet train that just got canceled because of complaints about lack of transparency on the bidding process. But if you go back a little bit to some of the other scandals, like Grupo Mexico that allegedly polluted an agricultural region in Sonora State, then you've got Oceanografía that defrauded Pemex and Mexican banks. Then you've got the big scandal that cost the country billions of pesos and fined Citigroup a few hundred million dollars. So these seem to be happening one after the other.
Well, it's partly because it's, you know, you've got these major conglomerates here in Mexico in which the CEOs and other board members sit on each other's boards. So there's really a lot of protection one of another. Let me go in a little bit more to this company involved in this this mansion scandal. It's this company has at least, you know, somewhere between 7 and 10 subsidiaries. And those subsidiaries have engaged, I mean, just in the state of Mexico, while Peña Nieto was governor from 2005 to 2011, they got more than somewhere close to $600 million in contracts for construction of highways, construction of a hospital, doing other road building, also doing publicity and providing air services through a subsidiary of helicopters and air transport. But it's not only in the state of Mexico. They've also had numerous contracts in Jalisco State, in Tamaulipas. So they've really benefited through close relations with, you know, especially the PRI, but Peña Nieto, but also other leaders in the PRI. And so when it came out that this that they were part of this consortium for this, you know, about $4 billion high-speed rail link between Mexico City and Querétaro that got canceled all of a sudden, hours before the release of this, you know, bombshell news that, in fact, the company had provided this mansion to the president's wife. I think for a lot of Mexicans who read this, you know, with a lot of attention, it was just a sign of, you know, of massive influence peddling.
Yeah, basta, basta, enough,
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I'm
afraid we've run out of time, but I really thank you for joining us, Tim.
You're welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Johnson, who's the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America and serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. He joined us from Mexico City. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.